Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of the Elden Ring podcast. This episode is entitled The Lore of the Lands Between, and as I'm sure you can imagine, we're about to dive in. We are a couple of months into the release of Elden Ring. It has received an immensely positive reception, and I couldn't be happier for the team led by Miyazaki-san. And I suspect, not jinxing anything, but I suspect that the Game Awards are going to be all theirs. Like, it's just going to belong to Elden Ring, and I think that that will mean that three Game Awards in a row will essentially be sort of owned by Elden Ring. Both, you know, first anticipated, then the trailer release, and then this one will be, I believe it will win Game of the Year, especially since Breath of the Wild 2 will be pushed back, and has been pushed back, rather. So, like the wonderful and extremely hardworking DC, Redgrave, rather, before them, Uncivil Procedure has very awesomely posted 21 days ago, as of time of recording, a very thorough overview of the lore and story of Elden Ring. Thoughts and discussion are welcome, so what I'll be doing first and foremost is putting this amazing post in the description. I won't be reading every single line, because I want you all to dive on in and give them the thumbs up. It's only sitting at about 50 upvotes, and the Chapel of Anticipation episode crossed 4,000 and almost into 5,000 listeners, so I know that there's going to be a fair audience for them, so I would love for you to go over to that post and give it a quick like, because I think that they would sincerely appreciate it. Radio, everyone. So, I love that they start with, note that the names that being with G, M, or R are generally related to each other. Also note that a heavy theme or motif in this game is duality, twins, split personalities. Now, again, that's what you're also getting with this, is my annotated kind of commentary. Also, if I end up running out of time with this, it will end up being The Lore of the Lands Between Part 1, and then I'll continue. Obviously, there's quite a bit that's been made for this game, you know, in terms of, obviously, we're talking about George R. R. Martin here, so we're talking about a lot of lore development. Right. But yes, there are not an insignificant number of people, I'm sure, who would say that Elden Ring is the opportunity to take what Dark Souls was, Dark Souls 3 specifically, and bring it into the open world. It's very clear that the engine's the same, and that you basically took Dark Souls 3, blasted open its open world, added immeasurably more regions and enemy variety, and, you know, I would even say solidity of gameplay than in any other From Software title. That's why it really is, you know, sort of sweeping all the categories, really, with regards to, you know, let's just take, for example, aesthetics. It's by far and away the most smoothly, beautifully running, you know, well-designed, take for example a piece of armor from Elden Ring versus one from Dark Souls 3, there's absolutely no comparison, so it's the best looking From Software title, but it is also the largest and the most, I would say, dense in terms of lore, which is saying something considering the Dark Souls titles, you know, had their own set of lore. I have the Dark Souls compendium just in the other room, and even though, you know, part two was handled by essentially a different team, there's a fair amount of unity there. But anyway, this is just me saying that, you know, for example, take the Princes of Lothric, there was duality there. There's a fair bit of emphasis on, you know, there's a, you know, like a Lord of Flame kind of situation, Lord of Blood. There's like one of the endings has to do in Elden Ring has to do with like burning the world down. So I would almost say, and I hope this is taken in the right spirit, that that Dark Souls 3, you know, basically received the most astounding, beautiful, wonderful kind of form of rebirth, in a sense. You know, there's even some themes of rebirth in this one as well. But anyway, let us continue. Finally, note that multiple outer gods seem to exist in this world, and an Elden Lord can refer to whatever ruling entity that has allied with an outer god in a way that would make the Elden title proper to capture this ruler's true power as a lord. So, you know, I guess you could say from Bloodborne onwards, in an explicit way, in a more subtle way, the Dark Souls titles did have a sense of, like, the, I call it the sort of mid-game Miyazaki twist, or Lovecraftian twist, but I think Bloodborne really sort of laid that foundation, and then that was definitely built on by Sekiro with the Village. And very similar was, as I was going through Lands Between, down in some catacombs, and what do you know it, up I just crane my neck upwards, and there is one of those frightening kind of void beings, you know, with the human skull and everything. So, so yeah, my God. I just think that, you know, this theme of the folly of trying to kind of, you know, maybe bring oneself close to or merge with or become part of the cosmos is just, you know, a great theme of, like, humbling oneself as, you know, the human race is, that's why stories exist, to kind of remind us to do that. And I like that commentary is made in Elden Ring as well about that sort of folly, you know. So there we go. The game refers to the greater will, which, although ambiguous, appears to refer to a literal entity that is an outer god, as in, like, the greater will is like a creature. It seems to be some sort of cosmic parasite, but who knows? This entity's influence is represented by the golden light, Grace, that is seen everywhere. Queen Marika, or Marika, will come to be this entity's vassal, who bears the Elden Ring, which is the physical manifestation of the greater will's power, and is made up of disparate runes, and is also the source of the power of the Erdtrees. Now, so, you know, take Tolkien, for example, with you know, the seven, you know, we'll see it later in September, obviously, with the Rings of Power. But this notion of a single ring being composed of many facets, many runes, there's a beautiful, you know, evocation and echoing there. Echoing makes it sound like it's less material or less substantive, but I'll say it definitely a kinship there, definitely, and a sense of, like, Lord of the Rings definitely being Elden Ring's ancestor, with that theme of, you know, the greater will, and then the Elden Ring, and then these great runes feeding into. So I guess the analogy would be, like, you know, Tolkien has his seven rings, nine rings, etc., three rings, and those feed into, or rather are all kind of, inferior to or serving to the One Ring, you know. So I just love that, and I just wanted to kind of take a brief moment to comment on that. The two fingers, which really freaked me out, but also I did love the sort of Miyazakian strangeness of the fingers element in Elden Ring, are literal emissaries that try to enact the desires of the greater will. They try to, you know, not sure exactly how the two fingers are created or born, or could they possibly be from space. The Golden Order, as a human system of beliefs, eventually comes to be to help enact the greater will's desires. So, as is common in, you know, human mythologies, we come across, like, imagine a tribe of warriors, or just, I guess, a tribe coming across, like, a volcano. And then what kind of stories does a tribe come up with about why a volcano is there? And, you know, you'll look across all the different world cultures of, like, maybe a volcano is like a pockmark from, like, a warrior firing their a god for firing their bow into the planets or something, and they'll come up with all these explanations. So I love the idea of like the Golden Order sort of being this organization that is like, they're just trying to kind of build themselves around trying to explain these phenomena. And if you came across these like seemingly immortal strange fur-covered fingers, they are extremely strange. I think even by Miyazaki standards, that there's just these fingers that just sort of sit there, like the three-ringed one and the two-ringed one, two-fingered and three-fingered rather, sorry. Very, very interesting. Anyway, so let's go. Starting at the beginning, the lands between were first ruled by the dragons, led by Dragon Lord Placidusax. I thought it was Pellucidax, but there you go. Dragon Lord Placidusax. The dragons were allied with an unnamed outer god, who, over time, abandoned them and led to a soft decline of the dragons' power, and probably also to the crumbling of their sky city, Farum Azula, which gets subsumed in some sort of temporal vortex for some reason. Also, around this time, what is now known as the Erdtree was in a primordial form and was understood as the crucible of life. So, parking the little lore analysis bus here, I've always found Miyazaki to take sort of that same quality as Hideaki Anno in choosing certain words and phrasings simply for the feel of the word. You know, Anno with Evangelion, he said he like, you know, a lot of people read a lot of meanings into what I write, and like, you know, I've written essays and stuff about it, but in many ways I've been picking words and like the crucible of life, like, you know, it's a beautiful sounding word, but there's an argument to be made that that doesn't terribly make too much immediate sense, at least unless we receive a lot more context from here. It's certainly an evocative, you know, phrase, the crucible of life. At some point, the greater will sends the Elden Beast within a star as a vassal, and as mentioned, Marika then becomes the vassal of the greater will. The Elden Beast is absorbed into her body. All that is known about Marika, before this is that she is descended from the Numan race, which is a race that originated outside the lands between. So a little nomenclature here. So Numan refers to, as often, if you look it up in Google, it's the spirit of a place, Numen, that's what they mean. One of the episodes we'll be doing is about nomenclature. Very, very awesomely, we've had a fellow r/Elden Ring commenter and community member has actually taken what I had written, which was this, starting to write a sort of nomenclature etymology post, and it absolutely skyrocketed, it made me very happy, you know, to see that someone was like, as passionate about like just the, you know, stuff that you wouldn't normally think of, but that is like hidden meanings, in Miyazaki's names. So yeah, I think you'll really enjoy that one, and I'm looking forward to recording that sort of the names of the land between, whatever that episode ends up being called. So, all that is known about Marika is that before she was descended, race that originated outside the lands between. So keep in mind, Marika, not native of the lands between, which is very interesting. For whatever reason, after becoming the greater will's vassal, Marika goes into the lands between and establishes Laendel, right, which is the capital. This will lead to many conflicts, one of which is the conflict with the dragons. As can be seen in the capital, the dragons attack, presumably for encroaching on their territory. But ultimately, with the greater will's power, Laendel is able to stave off the dragons. Once again, the themes of disrupting the natural order. So that place was once the domain of dragons. There's a beautiful kind of thread of melancholy to the dragons, it's sad, you know, like you kind of feel for them, especially that large, you know, the mother dragon, which took me close to half an hour plus to bring down with just my sort of sword swipes, but couldn't ignore all those runes. But yeah, there's definitely a sense of, as I've mentioned before, with Tolkien and J.D. Cronus' writing, of the good times, you know, being long gone, and things beginning to, you know, to tarnish, I guess you could say, you know, to diminish. And I love the idea of Marika, you know, taking it upon herself, believing that she's worthy of these lands, and then sort of, you know, acting as this, yeah, again, it says there's implications about it being like a malevolent intelligence that sort of infects her, a predatory intelligence. Also, I figured it's worth mentioning, now that we're almost in May, that almost a year ago, you know, there was a lot of speculation about, like, okay, so if we go cosmic, what's it going to be? And a lot of people made that leap that, you know, the Elden Ring would be a parasite, and that there would be, you know, darker intelligences behind this, like, seemingly pretty idyllic land. It's definitely the brightest. Again, many, many people have made comments on this, but compared to the other, you know, From Software titles, the palette of Elden Ring is, I think it's, I guess it would be, I can't say quite my favorite, because I do love Bloodborne just to my heart, but I would say definitely the most varied, and you know, I could just jump into the lands between any time and just spend some time there, whereas Yharnam is very intense. No cute little, you know, little bunny rabbit squirrels there, definitely. So there you go. Over time, ultimately, yep, Stave Off the Dragon. So over time, some individuals will join dragon cults and wish to become them. Also, figured I'd mention, just to kind of build a bit of atmosphere, I always imagine when I'm recording the show that you're all with me in the, you know, in the round hold, the round table keep, rather, and that we're just like nooked up cozily somewhere with like a fireplace somewhere, and I'm like reading from like one of those many books about the lands between, and then sort of have you all kind of gathered around, and we can just sort of share our stories. And yeah, Elden Ring is definitely become an instant classic in games, and I can see a lot of kids, for example, now growing up with it and saying, yeah, you know, Elden Ring was my Ocarina of Time kind of thing, and I fully and totally believe that. And yeah, so and I have lots of cozy Ocarina of Time memories, and you know, when I'm recording the Zelda podcast, I definitely imagine myself to be in like a Kokiri village of some kind when I'm recording, and you know, and like slightly raining outside and all that, you know, fireplace nearby, all that cozy stuff, you know. So I figured I'd mention, just as a bit of, you know, mind's eye, just to kind of, you know, establish that sort of energy as we read on. So, Greater Will, Stave Off the Dragons. Okay, over time. Yes, over time, yeah, joining dragon cults and wish to become them, becoming dragons, again, from Dark Souls 3. For example, the magma worms are actually humans who attempted to transform into dragons. But it only half worked, and they end up cursed to never fly. Eventually, Marika's son Godwin, Marika's family tree is addressed a little later, will even befriend one of them, namely Fortisax. Little aside, I once had a dream about a dragon, and it told me its name. I'm sorry to kind of drop this sort of random. And the name was Fumador, like fumes, and then E, and then D-O-R, which, you know, roughly etymologically can be resolved as smoke of gold, so like golden smoke. So I once had a dragon come to me in a dream and say that their name, or in some way communicate to me that their name was Golden Smoke. So, and that's, this character immediately became part of the quantum myth, which I'm writing in the background. It's like the lovely podcast. I love them so much. As you can see in the bios of all of them, it's all about redirecting folks to, you know, well, okay, if this person really enjoys discussing this stuff, well, then if you had any further interest in sort of, you know, all of this stuff ends up informing and inspiring, I'm sure, many of you, you know, with all of your creative endeavors, and then maybe just like that recreation aspect of just relaxing to games. But for me, all of these outlets, God of War, Avatar, Elden Ring, Kojima, they all inform the quantum myth, which is like I stripped down everything and I just want to leave a book behind, like the quantum myth, and it's going to be this massive book that is sort of synthesizes all of my influences and stuff. And Ueda and definitely Hirotaka Miyazaki are foremost in that. You'll be able to tell, and there will definitely be dragons, definitely. Right. So Fortisax, what a great name. Saxon, fortress. Great etymological kind of crumbs there to explore. Another will join the Magic Academy, right? So let's backtrack. Marika's son Godwin, Marika's family tree is addressed later, will befriend one of them, namely Fortisax, and another dragon will join the Magic Academy. And overall, again, evoking Sif. Oh, no, not Sif. I'm blanking. But the albino dragon that in the very first Dark Souls. Another will join the Magic Academy, and overall the dragons are clearly more pacified, and that conflict is now over and dealt with by the time that you play Elden Ring. Sometime around the establishing of Laendel, the primordial Erd Tree is transformed into its current version. The Crucible Knights that defended the prior version were allowed to remain. One important falling out from this transformation is for the Omens. Before the Golden Order was established, those born with signs of the Crucible, e.g. horns and tails, were seen as a blessing from the Crucible. Again, we're talking about Fel Omen, you know, and Mog as well. Margit and Mog. I could just imagine like a Peanuts cartoon with them too. Also, I always feel free to like gently poke fun or have little divergences for the things I really love. It's like a sign of like me being secure in my love for the thing that I'm happy to kind of like take little asides about, like, yeah, who wouldn't want to see like a Peanuts style cartoon of some of these characters? I'm sure there's an artist out there who's rendered them all again in direct full bore credit to the From Software design team. The aesthetics of Elden Ring, the silhouettes, the character and boss and creature designs are all so arrestingly beautiful and unique and iconic in their way. Again, this team, they just closed themselves out. They just made a game like it was the 90s. And if you're wondering why a lot of 90s games have really memorable silhouettes, it's because they did the exact same thing as the Elden Ring guy. Although back then they didn't have a choice, there was no internet. So, but these guys willingly sort of did that, which, again, I've mentioned this on other shows, like, it for me almost makes that effort kind of translate to, well, for them it was an option, you know, for them it was something they had to impose on themselves, like, you know, Jack White having like amazing guitars and all kinds of new tech, like Pro Tools and all that, but he chooses to like record, you know, in really lo-fi ways and by choice. So I always like to throw at that, like, there's a little mini argument to be made that maybe modern titles are the furthest thing from like being out of touch with analog. They're more in touch than ever because they are choosing it actively, whereas before it was the only option. So again, I'd like to take little moments to just show a whole heap of appreciation to the Elden Ring art design team, and I cannot wait for the Design Works book, which we're all waiting for. So keep an eye on that, and maybe have a Google alert for that one, as I am definitely likely to set up, although I find myself looking it up often anyway, so I kind of don't need the Google alert, regardless, I do hope that materializes. Someone on reddit.com/r/ Elden Ring did mention that there was a big space between the release of the game, I think for Sekiro, and the Design Works, so no worries at all, take your time, but I'm sure it'll be a massive tome. I think it'll be at least two sizes, maybe even three times as large as Sekiro, so there you go. Rightio. Right, Omens, yes. Sorry, I'm just like one of those doddering old, you know, folks in like the, you know, the study of the medieval kind of like, out in the library, and it's like, oh, where are my glasses? You know, I'm just trying to find where I was at, you know. So anyway, they're seen as a blessing, right? From the crucible afterwards, though, it is viewed as a curse, presumably, because the greater will views it as an affront to its unity of power. Maybe referring to how they kind of, actively, stick out of the crowd, and that sort of disrupts that notion of unity. So a little bit xenophobic there. I love that. Again, there's that theme of duality, which Uncivil Procedure is talking about. You do align yourself, or you choose to align yourself with the different factions, opposing factions, in this game. Also, I love that, like, a new elder type title is on the stage, I guess, or in town rather. So it's not just Elder Scrolls now, it's Elden Ring. And I would love, for example, in Elder Scrolls 6, for there just to be a little tiny nod to Elden Ring of some kind. I know that they I think maybe included some, it was Assassin's Creed Valhalla that included Lord of the Rings reference, but I would love for Elder Scrolls 6 to just give a little hint to, because as I read along, I just like, oh yeah, like, in some ways they're sort of kindred, and I could imagine something where, if it reads as true to something that would happen in the Elder Scrolls as well, that there would be, a species where it's like, oh, it's seen as a blessing, and then it's seen as a curse, and, and so, yeah, that's just a little reverie for you, that I wanted to kind of, capture, and for you to ponder on. So they're shunned into the sewers and elsewhere, There you go. It's unfortunate, So in general, it is unclear how much of Marika's actions and motivations could be ascribed to her or to the greater will, who uses her as its vassal. Anyways, those born with horns are shunned into the sewers and elsewhere. This would even escalate into omen killers deciding to hunt them down, and was presumably a contribution to the discrimination in general to any others seen as impure, which would also include the demi-humans and the misbegotten. I love that word. And the bats, who sing a song in real-life Latin lamenting their new fate, the Albinorix, and the Vulgar Militia. So all of these, again, diverse factions, inarguably, and I think it'll actually be maybe a bit of a struggle. This might end up being the be-all, end-all of, like, the From Software, unless we're talking PS6 and they go twice as big as Elden Ring, and then twice as detailed, like, it's unthinkable, the amount of time that would be spent there. We'll take my nice little old man tangent-taking, doddering kind of break here to mention I dived in as far as possible as I could into Elden Ring. We, at the time, concurrently, as probably accounts for some of the shows, in a perfect world, I didn't have a full time, and this, I could jump on this fully. And if you did feel like, supporting the show, in the link tree for Elden Ring podcast, there's the Apple, you can see that there, and then, as I mentioned before, there's the the Quantum Myth and everything, if you want to kind of check out my writings and stuff. But you can support there. There's just a PayPal thing. I think it's simpler than the Ko-fi or the Patreon or anything. It was tough because Mum, my mother-in-law to be, actually passed away on the day that Elden Ring came out. As I probably discussed a little bit on the streams there, the channel where I posted them to, the main Tweety Gamer, that's what it started as back in 2015, but the main channel where they were there, I've deleted those. They're archived somewhere. I might, if I end up having some really ultra-fast, everything consolidated, easily searchable, PC or MacBook setup, or rather iMac, sorry, or Mac Pro setup, that I could just bring up that footage, maybe I'll bring it out. But throughout, just to kind of catch you up, I was just talking through it. I was obviously engaging with the story, but that idea of this being concurrent with Mum and, her passing and stuff, and it was this really beautiful ability to escape, and I dove in as far as possible, like as long as I could, but then literally, like, work and then life came in, and then it became that thing of, like, I just don't have the time to to attempt this boss another three times. I got his how far I got, then I just, you know, did my customary thing, and I got as further into this game than any other. I really hammered away, you know, the tree sentinel gone, or rather the whatever the sentinel that was guarding Laendell. Like, I used that fucking diseased hound, and I took them down, and you know, explored Laendell, dangerous fucking place. Those white kind of gloppy orb type things. We'll dive into those later. And I beat Margit, or Morgoth, but then right up to the Elden, rather the Erd Tree, and then, you know, they said, okay, well, can't have access, and Melina, you know, sent me off to the lands of the giants where I currently am. But I said, like, you know what, I think I've pretty much explored most of the areas of this place, you know, a good 60-70%, and that's kind of where I reach. It's like, to have authorship of my own experience of a title is immensely important, and you know, and again, it becomes that aspect of practicality. So what I did after that, I just recognized, like, okay, this is what I'm able to do, but I can't wait to dive into the story. So I did. I dove fully in. There's, like, let's plays and all that other kind of stuff. It's very different from the 90s. Like, you can experience a title in sort of a hybrid way, play most of it yourself, watch the rest, not play any of it at all, hunker down and only play it. So I like to be one of those sort of hybrid figures there. And all throughout, I can get hand on heart, say, you know, in some of the earlier episodes of the podcast, I talked about, like, yep, I'm going to do it. I'm going to finish it. It's immensely, immensely difficult. And there is definitely no practical way with my lifestyle and my work, you know, the bandwidth that I have commitments towards with other aspects of my life, that I'd have been able to, you know, beat it. But I do so love it, and watched all three endings, and, you know, truly, truly, truly love this game. And so, with that in mind, let us continue. Noteworthy, during this time period of Laendell and the Golden Order, immortality is a power conferred by the Great Will, and the Rune of Death is held by Queen Marika's half-brother, Maliketh, for safekeeping. A little nomenclature trivia here. So we have three now in the three pretty major fantasy worlds. We have Maliketh, 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 right? Who is from, I believe, Lord of the Rings. Then Malakath, we have from, who's like a dark elf, in, and there's two A's, Malakath, in Warhammer. And then we have this, you know, well done on, like, you know, pivoting away from any kind of, like, you know, Games Workshop or the Tolkien Estate giving you a call. But yes, Maliketh. Both of them have that nomenclaturic aspect of malinome, like it's mal, usually it connotates bad, right? And so there you go. So Maliketh has the Rune of Death. Well, technically the Rule of Death, or rather the Rune of Death, was held by the Dusk-Eyed or Gloam-Eyed Queen, whose followers were the Godskin Apostles that used the Black Flame and seemed to also use the Deathbirds as its emissary. Maliketh slew the Queen and took her Rune of Death for himself and Marika's purposes. Right? So, afterwards, it seems that beings during this time do not die up until they visit the Erd Tree, at which point, and this is only a theory, they are presumably absorbed into the Greater Will or something like that. Avati talked about, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, talked about returning to the roots, literally. You just join with the roots of the world, evoking a little bit of, you know, the roots being as they do resemble tentacles, evoking Soul Reaver's notion that there's this big parasitic, you know, elder god. Highly, highly suggest you dive into Soul Reaver, and maybe even, you know, skip forward a few minutes if you don't want to be spoiled. But Soul Reaver, Legacy of Cain, Soul Reaver, there was an elder god, and you know, initially thought to be your benefactor, your guide, and then turns out this is a big, you know, predatory intelligence that is putting himself between, you know, shoving himself into that natural process of life and death, and sublimated as that process, he says, well, I am the custodian of that process. I am the one who guides that process of the wheels of the soul's turning, you know. But that's couldn't be further from the truth. This is a parasite, and that's a lie, an outright lie. And he's just consuming the souls, not letting them spin in that wheel, just consuming them. So I assume something pretty similar here is at hand with the, after the rune of death happened, then, like, instead of the, you know, the souls being able to pass on into eternity, they actually get straight up devoured by or absorbed, as it is said here, into the greater will, the Elden Ring and the Oatree. Here's one thing I like, and kind of reminds me of Tolkien, is, you know, Miyazaki is fond of the, and I'm encountering some of this in the, as I write the Quantum Myth, is the temptation to add versions and different names, and, you know, there's Mithrandir and Gandalf and, you know, Stormcrow, and you know, that's things are known by many names. And also Game of Thrones creator George R. R. Martin is also very fond of the multiple name thing. And, you know, with for example, the Quantum Myth, you know, the very first entity is called the Prime Entity, but is another name for them is Orvisutar, you know, the first being. So three titles there. And then the progeny, you know, the gods, the elementals, and the aspects, and the resonance, and the vessels, etc. You know, so, and the Ulefon, of course. Yeah, which is the aspect. But basically, yeah, you know, this idea of things having many names. So, for example, in some sense, to be very simplistic, the Erdtree, the greater will, you know, the great runes even, and the Elden Ring itself, you know, because they're so closely packed in lore-wise, if this was like, you know, a 1992 video game and they like had a limited budget, limited time, they'd be like, okay, let's just focus on one. It's about the Elden Ring. Yeah, the Elden Ring, you know, or rather, because sometimes there's like the thing that speaks for the Elden Ring, or the thing that is the essence of the Elden Ring. And, you know, and I love that diversification, because more characters, more lore, which I love, you know. But I figured I'd just make a little comment on that. So there you go. So around this time, as you know, beings are not able to die, at the fringes of, I suppose, the outer galaxy of this planet, which we don't know what the planet is called, but, you know, but at the fringes are the outer gods, some other outer gods. These include the Formless Mother, a blood-based outer god, a god of scarlet rot, the Frenzied Flame, the One-Eyed Fell God of the Giants, essentially a fire god, and the aforementioned Glow-Eyed Queen, essentially a goddess of death. So what we have here is, if you break out your Bloodborne textbook, we have here a parallel to Formless Aiden. There's literally the word formless there, Formless Mother. We also have, you know, something frenzied, and then there's definitely, basically what I'm, just to cut to the chase, you have a little mini pantheon here of outer gods, well, greater, you know, great ones. Yeah, so I love that. And there is a kinship there between the two works, in terms of like, okay, well, there's these gods, and you have Kaz, and you have Erden, and you have, you know, and Amygdala is, I think there's still a debate raging about whether they're a true great one. But there you go. So I just love it. I also, some of this stuff, again, similar to, as I played through the game, I made my way a fair amount in, and then, you know, I started discovering stuff. So I actually haven't read through this is, I'm discovering some stuff on my own, so myself rather, so we're sort of experiencing it together. And once again, shout out to Uncivil Procedure. Their details are in the description, so please head over and then give them a shout for sure. So let us keep diving in. I'll get to most of those later, says Uncivil Procedure. But for now, I want to camp out on the giant's fell god, as this great one, or outer god, leads to war. Marika wages a war on the fire giants, led by a storm ruler, presumably because of the threat of their forged flame, a very powerful fire, you know, again, you know, profaned flame, Dark Souls 3, a very powerful fire that emanates from the giant's pact with the one-eyed fell god and has the potential to burn the Erd tree. So, you know, Erd tree, very powerful tree, but similar to maybe that notion of, you know, the ring can only be unmade in the fires of its making. And what's to say that these, you know, fell gods or outer gods didn't make the Erd tree, and that because this is a flame that originates from the outer gods, that it's the only thing that can burn the Erd tree. So again, another beautiful evocation of Lord of the Rings. But again, always so distinct. Again, the two works are not directly comparable. There's just these beautiful little flourishes that sort of, as I mentioned in the earlier episodes of the podcast, like this is two friends. I am sure they became friends throughout this process, who grew up in the same source material, in one in the East, one in the West, and they're coming together to sort of give tribute in some subtle ways throughout the telling of their own unique story, which fuses way more influences than just Tolkien, obviously. You have, you know, George R. R. Martin, who weaves in his love of, you know, the War of the Roses and all of that, like everything that informed Game of Thrones in many ways. But he's got very diverse influences, and, you know, Miyazaki, look no further than Berserk, look no further than, you know, I think he mentioned like Sorcery and, you know, some of these pen and paper stuff. So there's definitely more at play here, but it is so beautiful to see those little nods to, like, grandfather Tolkien. Like, I really like that. It's very, very touching, I think, you know? So, yeah, but the fire giants, and again, fire giants, very evoking of Norse myth. You know, Surtr was a fire giant, a fire titan almost, and the one who is prophesied to bring about the end, you know, with his sword and all that lava and stuff. So look that up, definitely. Shouts out to God of War Ragnarok, coming out hopefully later this year. And if it does come out later this year, that'll be the one game that can even have a chance of holding up a candle. I know I said in the Wizarding podcast that Elden Ring doesn't have a chance compared to Hogwarts Legacy. I was very caught up. Oi, don't turn off the show. I definitely had a moment because I love the Wizarding world, but let's be really, like, boom, like, you know, I love their endeavor, I really do, and I'm ready to be surprised, I really am. So I'm not locking it down and being kind of dogmatic or you know, zealous, but you know, Elden Ring, we're talking a company that has been sharpening that axe, like really refining their craft, right? And, you know, I do, like, Avalanche shouts out, you are literally making a dream come true game, but you have that Disney Infinity stuff, and just objectively, this is not a dig, but you just objectively have less titles to your name. That being said, you know, Guerrilla, that titles of this nature to your name, of course, but that being said, Guerrilla absolutely blew my mind with Horizon Zero Dawn, and, you know, it's a tie in some ways. Well, actually, is it a tie? No, it goes to Breath of the Wild, Game of the Year 2017 for me. But that I even said that is a testament to how much they impressed with their first title of its kind in their over. So, you know what? Shouts out to Avalanche. But I think this might go to Elden Ring, folks. Anyway, that the heat is on, as they used to say. And one of my favorite 90s shows, Iron Chef. So, who will take it? Whose cuisine reigns supreme? Anyway. Okay. I do enjoy my little tangents, and I like trying to find my place again, and I hope you folks are enjoying it as well. And again, as I mentioned, oh my god, and some people do, they just straight up read and they don't credit. No, it's, for me, this is me honoring Uncivil Procedure and their great work and using it just as a bit of a subtle spine to what we're discussing. And he does they really do beautifully kind of provide this lovely kind of chronology, which if I was Future Press, I'd be looking at this and then maybe using this as like, hey, so this wonderful community member put something like this together. Can you go through this and just correct and like rearrange, and so that we can put together the Elden Ring compendium, which will be different from the Art of Elden Ring. And hopefully Miyazaki deems such a thing to be like, yes, awesome. Reminder to self, My freaking edition of Edge that was supposed to arrive with the Elden Ring cover still hasn't arrived. So I don't know if anyone else has been having problems with that. I guess you can email, or maybe just send a message to the Instagram is where I'm on most frequently, if you've had any troubles with that too, because that's, yeah, I'll have to email them again, or email them rather. So there we go. So the Giants Pact, this is what's key here. So the One-Eyed Fell God has the potential to burn the Oak Tree. So Marika has two noteworthy generals at this time, Radagon and Horalu, who is a chieftain of the neighboring Badlands. Radagon, etymologically, you know, it's a rearrangement of dragon, red dragon. Horalu, a little bit more outside of my knowledge base, but it sounds like an or sound, like a sound you'd make when you're sort of, like something like beholding something great. And Lu has you know, ties to loyalty, like loyal. So someone who is grand and loyal. Which does describe the character to some extent, you know, loyal enough to kind of carry out into the spirit world and sort of retain their essence in some way. And that was a tough, oh my God, that was a tough fight. I ended up having to just fucking aggressively back away and use, you know, Ashes of War. Before it was nerfed, I was using the Hoarfrost Stomp. I wonder if Hoarfrost and, Horalu have an etymological link. It's more than likely that they do. So, Marika has these two kind of champions, right? Horalu, chieftain of the neighboring Badlands. So, I don't know if it specifies here, but outside of the Lands Between, potentially. So, one noteworthy thing that occurs in the war is the trolls betray the giants and ally with Marika. Oh, also, before I go on, you know, Ice and Fire. That's Game of Thrones. You think of, you know, you think of A Song of Ice and Fire, but some of this imagery immediately made me think of Frank Frazetta. And, you know, we had on the God of War, episodes, the God of War podcast, we had, Tucker Thomasson, who, you know, Frost of the Ice Giant, like look at the titles of these Thorax songs. I think, Thorax, Thorr -AXE. They're not active anymore. I think he's doing Throne of Iron, which is this great sort of D&D inspired band. But yeah, he would have a lot to say about trolls and giants here. And he is definitely a Bakshi person like me. We recently actually, you know, started the first few processes of the Bakshi podcast, because I wanted to talk about Fire and Ice. But I mean, as soon as I read that, you know, the idea of the chieftain from Outland, like, that's very Frank Frazetta, that this queen would have, like, a knight as a champion, but then also, like, a barbarian. You know, it's just so Frazetta and so Bakshi. And as they're going through, actually, the Game Grumps guys, you know, Danny had a moment where he just said, like, this is the best. And I totally agree with that. Like, he's the guy who wrote The Mystic Crystal, and he's sort of embedded in fantasy in many ways with a lot of his songs. And so I just love that this truly, like, not hammy, but like just fantasy person's fantasy is, but also grounded, you know, nothing too much in sort of that, you know, like oversaturated sort of Blind Guardian kind of, even though again, Blind Guardian's great. We had, my awesome musician friend, on one of the recent episodes where we talked about Blind Guardian, but I love this like unfetteredly, unabashedly, fantasy-tastic premise, coated in darkness, and that's when we will get later to, you know, some very intense individuals. And I think just by my pace that I'm going at, this will definitely be a multi-part thing. For one scroll, I think we might be looking at two or three parts to this one. So because we have right now, we're coming up to the 10 minutes left. But I'm loving this. This is so fun. I hope you're enjoying it as well. So, yes, there you go. So, here's the thing, right, about trolls, right? They have holes in their stomachs. As they removed the eye that used to be there to mark the presence of the fell god, fucking evocative and beautiful, and you're wondering, like, why do they have that eye? Well, they took an eye out. You know, they used to have an eye there, the way that the fire giant boss, you can see later, That sort of great, great enemy, great foe. Very impressive. I ran up to him. With no strategy, didn't look up a strategy. I was just very interested. And I think I actually managed to run away, but yeah, very striking and beautiful. I can't help it. I will just say it. Very, Wolfgang Petersen, I think, who directed The Neverending Story, so much of the world, the lands between evokes, the Neverending Story for me, for sure. As does God of War in many ways. Something about Norse myth. I wonder if. Well, it was Michael Ende, so Ende is German, so maybe his kinship with his own, I guess, Germanic origins maybe fed into his story, The Neverending Story, which then went on to inform, I'm sure, many people's iterations. I do love that iterative nature of art. It's really beautiful. And yeah, I love it. Anyway, so Marika's forces win the war, right? So they win the war with the dragons, win the war with the giants. But when Marika realizes she cannot eradicate the flame, though, she cursed the last fire giant to attend to it for all eternity. And that giant responded with a curse on Radagon to have his red hair, which is something he resents, although some, like Radahn, view it with pride. Presumably, Radagon's hair was golden before the curse. The flame monks are tasked with guarding this flame, although over time they are seduced by its power. So, I've been in sort of Avatar land recently, folks. There's also, especially with Xbox announcing their showcase, with probably going to ramp up in that Kojima direction, and I've been doing some Kojima stuff, but I am 1/4, maybe we may end up being like a 5-part thing, who knows? 1/5 or 1/4 or whatever, the way through this, 6th, 7th, whatever, 8th. And I am head over heels for this sequential, beautiful, beautiful treatment that you've done. This immense, once again, uncivil procedure. That's who we're looking for. We emphasize crediting folks here. What an amazing job you've done. It's incredible, and it's so enrapturing. Please know that I'm just working as extensively as I can to signal boost this amazing work you've done. So. Well done, my friend, well done. So there you go. Wow. Let's read a teensy bit more before we close the book, The Lore of the Lands Between, Part 1. So, okay, are you ready? Again, Princess Bride, all that good stuff, you know. Are you ready for the last few pages before bedtime? Right. So Queen Marika decides to marry Horalu, who rebrands himself and takes on the moniker Godfrey, presumably to better enact the greater will. Note this marriage may have already happened earlier. Godfrey and Marika have at least 3 children, Godwin the Golden, as well as the twins Mog and Morgoth. Note that Morgoth is also Margit, who you fight at the beginning because he is testing you. Mog and Morgoth are banished after they are birthed because they bear the aforementioned omens, their horns, and are considered cursed. Mog will resent this and eventually fall into the league with the Formless Mother, while Morgoth takes over the capital in the long run, as he remains a true believer in the Golden Order, despite its treatment of him. So a couple of etymology things here. Mog definitely evokes the Moog synthesizer. fantasy and prog rock and prog albums are very linked. So I love Mog. And Morgoth is one letter away from Morgoth, from Tolkien, the great, very, very evil entity, who we will encounter in The Rings of Power, and we will be discussing on the Lord of the Rings podcast, for sure. So, let's see if you... Okay, all right, we can read a little more, and we'll just tie it off naturally in a minute or so, okay? One event, this is the teaser... Right, the cliffhanger for the next part. One event worth mentioning around now is the twin underground cities, of Nokron and Noxtella. The lore around these cities is a little small, but it would seem what happened is certain individuals, the Nox, started messing with alchemy in a way the greater will did not approve. In other words, they created things such as the Finger Slayer blade, a weapon powerful enough to kill the two fingers. This was naturally not considered right, and these individuals were essentially banished to live underground. Let's leave it there. I look forward to diving further headlong into this one, especially since we've established the new setup. We'll do a mini little bit of housekeeping on that respect. So everything you've seen before, the way things were, that's all shifted. Lots of IRL life stuff. So now it is just me. The Chronicle continues as it began, all the way back with the first ever episode I ever recorded for anything, which was for Bloodborne. And we're going to be having a very pleasant time with this sort of little chronicle here that we're doing. But in terms of the next few parts, which we'll be diving into, look, I can definitely see myself coming back to this, maybe even within the week, as in this coming week, you know, because it is so beautifully well written. And I myself, again, like you, I'm finding myself intrigued by what I'm reading. So yeah, you can expect this Elden Ring podcast. I don't know if you maybe were wondering, since it's been a while since the last episode, but we are definitely continuing. And as a bit of a forecast, there is, you know, whisperings of a nameless DLC, which would be truly beautiful. But again, this is like the game. If there was ever a game that didn't need, you know, DLC, it would definitely be Elden Ring. And for the team, who I don't know if they may or representatives from Bandai Namco or From Software, if you're listening to this, please allow me to express on behalf of the community, who has grown immensely. I haven't checked on the Reddit recently, but there is certainly something, you know, beyond words to what you've done with Elden Ring. It is such a special title. Just reading this makes me want to dive in, seriously, genuinely, and just mess around, you know, go grind in one of the amazing grind spots which we've all found, experience the nerfing maybe. There's a VR mode I think someone is working on. But I myself personally, just to kind of put something out there, I do love Alex Koss, is that his name? Who has done the Bloodborne graphic novel quadrilogy at this stage, although we're all here holding our breath for a fifth issue. If I can remember some of them, The Healing Thirst, A Storm of Crows. Ooh, it sounds a bit Game of Thronesy, that one. Yeah, definitely The Healing Thirst, that's one of them. And then something about The Void, I think. Look, getting later into the day for me, and as you know, I'm an old man, but please do look those up. Just Google, you know, Bloodborne graphic novels. Would absolutely love to hear that, you know, read on IGN tomorrow, like, Elden Ring is getting a graphic novel, that kind of stuff, you know? Also, I want to shout out to IGN for, you know, shifting their approach since Bloodborne. I didn't get, like, spoiled by any locations in their coverage, so shouts out to whatever you did there. That really, really makes me happy, so. But for the rest, I've sort of promised myself to dedicate the last few minutes to each of these, you know, audio missives, podcasts, two signal boosting what we do here. Once again, I'll just mention, for our immensely generous uncivil procedure, I'll be linking again. I've said it three times, why not? Three is a good number. This amazing sequential rendering of the lore. I'm sure, again, debate will always rage, as it always will for all of Miyazaki's titles, which is the gift of the incomplete, the gift of the storytelling, the shattered. Yeah, shattered storytelling method. It's like a gift to any long-standing community because of the reinterpretability of the material. So it's a true joy. It really is. And I don't know how far out. April, May, June, like roughly 5-6 months to the Game Awards, where we are all of us going to be cheering for Elden Ring, and it would be great to see, you know, Miyazaki on that stage, and you know, certainly, and the whole team, because I know that when they win the whole game of the year, like, more people go up on stage, and I would love to see this wonderful kind of moment in December of, like, people without masks and just on stage. You know, masks are important, you know, but you know, if they're not needed, then they're not needed. I hope they're not needed by that time. But folks, this has been wonderful. The Elden Ring podcast, pretty much everywhere on all socials. Please look at the link tree. And if you did enjoy the show, please do consider sending a little tip to the tip jar. It's just that PayPal there. I think it's like paypal.me/AlbaKethraOfficial. There you go. So, but until next time, folks, thank you so much and bye for now. Bye.